This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. New information out on the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, also known as the FISA Court. Now, that court operates in secret, approving government surveillance programs, including the two revealed by leaker Edward Snowden. But now we're learning that more than just guiding surveillance programs, the FISA Court has vastly expanded the case law, giving the NSA and other agencies the power to listen. In more than a dozen court rulings, the FISA Court has granted a vast array of new powers to the NSA to collect data on Americans on issues not just pertaining to terrorism, and here's the thing, also on nuclear proliferation, cyber attacks, and espionage. And the court has ruled that there is a Fourth Amendment exception when it comes to obtaining warrants for searches and seizures to collect and track the communications of Americans. That's new. The NSA says they only collect that information on foreigners, right? Well, Eric Lichtblau is a reporter for the Washington Bureau for our partner, the New York Times, who reported on these broad expansions of the FISA court for the paper. Hi, Eric.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. Eric, you refer in your piece to what has become, or what appears to have become to some, a parallel Supreme Court in the FISA court. What does that mean?
Well, that's right. I mean, this is really the court of last resort and the court of only resort for classified intelligence operations. It operates in secret. Only one side appears, which is the government. There are very few appeals even within the court itself. There is a review court that is also classified, also secret, also with only one party appearing. There's never been a case taken to the Supreme Court because that's so difficult to do. So the upshot is that you have a classified secret court with virtually no public scrutiny that is making, as we're now learning, really broad constitutional case law on surveillance and intelligence operations.
And you talk about an expansion of power, and I want to give one example. You talk about a case where the NSA was able to access an email attachment they thought, in this case, might have details of an Iranian nuclear plant. Now, the thing about that attachment was that it was an American communication. And you refer to this doctrine called special needs. It's not new, but the special needs doctrine was the thing that let the government do drug testing on railway workers because the risk to their privacy was worth the greater protection of the public, or, you know, drunk driving checkpoints because the infringement on privacy of a driver is worth protecting the driving public from drunk drivers. But they've applied this now in a much broader way.
Right, right. The court has taken this special needs doctrine, which, as you say, was established in a railway case in 1989. Probably its most prevalent use, you mentioned drunk driving checkpoints, but airport screenings, that there's an overriding public interest. They've taken that and now applied that in a way that it can be used to justify the collection of all this various metadata, telephone, et cetera, which they ordinarily would not be able to grab, we don't believe, in the vast dragnet effort that they have. But by carving out this exception under the special needs doctrine, they're saying this is still reasonable under the Fourth Amendment, which is the standard reasonableness of search and seizure, because of we're applying the special needs doctrine because there is an overriding public interest. So it's, some would say, lowering the bar. Others would say, you know, changing or adjusting the standards for what is required to make it reasonable under the Fourth Amendment.
But boy, Eric, I mean, that sounds like the kind of case that's ripe for review by the Supreme Court. I mean, Congress never intended special needs to apply to a massive pond of metadata of Americans' phone calls and emails that the NSA now has.
You're right. You would think that would be ripe for appeal. The problem is trying to make that happen when it is such a one-way street in the FISA court and the FISA appeals court as to bringing a challenge. You know, the Supreme Court has never weighed in on these issues. It's been hesitant, really, the last few years to weigh in at all on national security issues. The Bush wiretapping program that really gave way to all these congressional measures, which we saw beginning in 2007 and 2008, the Supreme Court stayed away from that. They ruled that the group that was trying to sue over that, where there was an allegation that the Bush program violated the law, did not have the standing to sue. So I would imagine this would be an even more difficult case to challenge in the appellate courts.
And is it the case also that a lawyer or an organization, even if they found a plaintiff who had standing, whose privacy had been allegedly violated or something, wanted to sue, that because the FISA court and its rulings are secret, that you can't even get your hands on the facts to begin with, to then try to go to the appeals court and get it to the Supreme Court? I mean, it's all kind of murky.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. There have been only a handful of decisions released in redacted form by the court in the 35 years that they've been around. And none of these current rulings that we're talking about that we discussed in Sunday's paper have been released publicly. So you're really kind of litigating in the dark to try and challenge that.
Now, the judges on the FISA court, and there are 11 of them, all appointed by Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts. There are 11 judges. They rotate in and out. We've heard that before. But they chafe at the criticism that they're a rubber stamp for the surveillance apparatus in this country. But you report that of 1,800 petitions to the court last year, not a single one was denied.
Not a single one was denied. And that's been true for years and years, that virtually no wiretap applications from the government are denied. And that, to be honest, has produced this criticism that it is just a rubber stamp.
I wonder if your sources or people in the intelligence apparatus, whoever they are, seeing that coming and seeing that pressure coming, might have wanted to get this story out there to maybe back those senators off from building public support against the FISA court here.
You know, I don't think that was the timing in terms of our story and the people that I talked to. There's been that pressure, to be honest, for several years, even before the Snowden leaks. The Justice Department and the Obama administration have been pledging for two and a half years now that they were going to try and declassify these rulings. We've had Senate nominees say, yes, we will try and put these out publicly. It hasn't happened. And that pressure has certainly only increased since the Snowden revelations, because now the NSA is back in the news where they don't like to be.
Well, difficult, complicated, and secret, and yet the FISA court appears to be creating a whole new body of case law without the help or the supervision of the United States Supreme Court. That is Eric Lichtblau, reporter in the Washington Bureau for our partner, The New York Times, reporting on the FISA court. Eric, thank you.